leftism has filled the void that secularism has produced. That is, all of the leftist religions, humanism, Marxism, communism, socialism, environmentalism, feminism, these are all left-wing religions. They have filled the void, and that's why Jews are so attracted. Jews are the most religious people in the world, but unfortunately for most of them, their religion isn't Judaism. Jews stayed religious, and they think that feminism and environmentalism and socialism, all these isms I mentioned, they are secular messianic movements. So yes, it filled a void. The state is the source of goodness. For the founders, the individual was the source of goodness. I take care of me, I take care of my family, I take care of my community. And for the left, the state takes care of me, the state takes care of my family, and the state takes care of my community.
I'm Ben Weingarten, and this is Big Ideas with Ben Weingarten, a podcast where we talk with exceptional thinkers and doers about the most important ideas and issues of our time and all time. In this week's episode, my guest is Dennis Prager. You may know Dennis as a longtime nationally syndicated radio host, or from his always thought-provoking columns, or perhaps as the namesake for PragerU, a site containing pithy, short, animated explainer videos that help viewers educate themselves on topics from economics to foreign affairs to culture. It's a fantastic way to unlearn the politicized things you or your kids were taught in school, and in my view, PragerU is a national service. Dennis is a living multimedia empire as an individual, and he is able to do this because he's one of the few truly deep, dynamic thinkers, expert in everything from religion and political philosophy to history. In a word, he's dedicated his life to studying, teaching, and advocating for Judeo-Christian and American values and principles across every medium, almost daily, to millions of people around the world with an uncommon common sense, moral clarity, and courage. I wanted to have Dennis on the podcast to talk about a number of subjects, from how he ended up a conservative, contrary to many of his Jewish intellectual peers, how religiosity impacts one's view of government, the core beliefs that separate leftists from non-leftists, the importance of Western values in immigration policy, the state of free speech in America, and PragerU's battle with social media censorship, and much more. If you like the conversation you're about to hear and you find it valuable, I hope you'll consider subscribing to, rating, and reviewing the podcast in the iTunes store or wherever else you're listening to us. And if you want to find out more about the show, you can visit our website at benweingarten.com/bigideas and follow me on Twitter at @bhweingarten. And now, without further ado, my conversation with Dennis Prager. So Dennis, I understand that you were inculcated in an environment in Brooklyn growing up where you studied at yeshiva, and obviously that religious background impacted your overall philosophy and your political beliefs. But on paper, a person would look at you and say, you're a Jewish American, Ivy League educated, highly intellectual, and that generally corresponds and correlates with liberal leftist. So how did you end up where you are ideologically?
In one sense, you gave the answer, actually, because I took the Torah seriously. It is not possible, in my opinion, obviously, to take the Torah seriously, to believe, as I do, that ultimately it's from God, and be on the left. That's why I'm not Orthodox, but that's why Orthodox Jews tend to be on the right. They take the religion seriously. They believe God is the source, and they reach certain conclusions. I'll give an example, because examples always make these things clear. Religious Jews and religious Christians know people are not basically good. The further secular you get, the more people believe people are basically good. I was at Berkeley. I gave a talk at Berkeley, earlier this year. And they said, would you debate left-wing students instead of giving a speech? I said, I would happily do that. That is actually my first choice. And people could watch it on YouTube until YouTube takes it down. And at the very end, what I did was, and I do this all the time, I clarify where I differ with people rather than try to argue them. Because it's much more effective. You don't yell at each other and the audience listens. And all I care about is people understand the differences between left and right. And then if they're open-minded and have good hearts, they'll go to the right. So the last thing I asked them, it was an hour and a half. The last thing I said, I'd just like to ask you guys, it was two guys. And they're both nice guys. Do you believe people are basically good? They said, of course. And I said, this is really important. And I told them, you believe that because America is such a nice place and you're naive. And the Torah is not naive. Yetzer lev ha'adam ra min urav. The will of man's heart is towards evil from his youth. and if you think human nature is basically good, you're an idiot. You are a bona fide fool. I actually have no tolerance for that belief, especially among Jews. After Auschwitz, to believe people are basically good shows you how much more irrationality there is in the secular world than in the religious world. That's the ultimate leap of faith that transcends logic and reason, to believe that human nature is basically good. Now, I'm not saying it's basically rotten. There's goodness in human nature, but it has to be mined like gold. It's very hard to bring out. So that's an example. You asked me how. Let's go back to the beginning. I'm sorry to give you such a long answer, but that's how. I took the Torah and Judaism seriously. There, you cannot be on the left. You can be liberal, but you cannot be on the left. And the liberal and left have nothing in common except big government. Alan Dershowitz is a living example of a liberal who fears the left much more than the right. He said that to me. It's on camera.
The students at Berkeley, I assume, also never even read the Federalist Papers, which say, of course, if men were angels, that is the starting point for the government. And they understood that because they had deeply thought about those exact Judeo-Christian principles that you were speaking to. Now, a corollary to this is, simple question, is the attachment to and belief in the power of government, of the state, so great in America today because it has filled the void of religion in American life? That is, for progressives, do you view the state as the church? I think progressives do sort of view the state as their church and secular humanism as their religion. So is it because it has filled the vacuum of a more secular nation, at the very least on the coasts?
Leftism has filled the void of that secularism has produced. That is, all of the leftist religions, humanism, Marxism, communism, socialism, environmentalism, feminism, these are all left-wing religions. They have filled the void, and that's why Jews are so attracted. Jews are the most religious people in the world, but unfortunately for most of them, their religion is in Judaism. Jews stayed religious, and they think that feminism, and environmentalism, and socialism, all these isms I mentioned, they are secular messianic movements. Karl Marx was the grandson of two Orthodox rabbis. People often don't know that. It's not irrelevant. And Trotsky and Rosa Luxemburg. I mean, it's just Howard Zinn. It's a hall of shame that Jews have been so active in producing such nihilist movements, which ultimately ended up, of course, anti-Semitic. There's nothing as anti-Israel today as the left. Nothing. So yes, it's filled a void. The government, you say, is that it? The state is the source of goodness. For the founders, the individual was the source of goodness. I take care of me. I take care of my family. I take care of my society, of my community. And for the left, the state takes care of me, the state takes care of my family, and the state takes care of my community. The state is the source of goodness. For the founders of America, the individual is.
How do you explain the sort of paradox, and I don't know if you've experienced this as well, where those who are conservative, classical liberal, etc., make arguments on materialist terms. That is, we support X policy because you will get Y benefit in your life from that policy. Whereas those on the left, leftist philosophy being a materialist philosophy, will not always point to your life is going to be better for this, but will make the argument that this is moral. So moral relativists making the argument that the philosophy that they're supporting is moral, is good, is just, is virtuous.
The moment one asks, does it work? One has left the left. That is not a left-wing question, does it work? Does it do good is not a left-wing question. Does it make me feel good is the left-wing question. The minimum wage is a perfect example. The New York Times in the 70s had an editorial. The correct minimum wage is $0.00. That was when the New York Times editorial page was not as left-wing as it is today. Today it is radically left. And today they are pro-minimum wage. What happened to the New York Times? Is there new evidence? Of course not. But they have become leftists. Leftists don't ask, does it do good? They don't care if something does good. They love ideas, not people. If you love people, you're a conservative. If you love ideas, you're on the left. And so minimum wage is a great idea. It sounds beautiful. But it puts people out of business. It doesn't hire people in the beginning of their work life. So they don't build the muscles necessary for the discipline of work. I mean, the downside is awful. But it feels good. And it's like recycling. Does it do good? Of course not. Does it feel good? Yes. The essence of leftism is feeling morally superior. Angela Merkel let 1 million people, 90% of whom share none of her values, into Germany, therefore into Europe, because she essentially admitted it. She wants to show that Germany is now good, to wipe the stain of the Holocaust and World War I and World War II away from its history. That's why. Did it do good? Of course it didn't do good. In fact, ironically, although I drop ironically, it always happens, this foolish left-wing policy is producing right-wing governments. She may have killed the European Union by doing this, but it never occurred to her. The question was, does it feel good? 1,000 rabbis said America should do similarly with tens of thousands of Muslim immigrants. Why did they sign it? Because it made them feel good. Look, we are moral, we're rabbis, we're Jews. We were not let in when our ships of refugees wanted safe ports. So we'll do this for the Muslims. And that feels good. And I understand that. That does. I know some rabbis who signed it. They knew that they had to. They would be ostracized from Jewish life if they didn't sign that petition. But look at what has happened in Europe. These people, most of these people bring in Jew hatred. Jews are signing a petition to bring Jew haters into America. If there is a stupider people than the Jews, I don't know who it is. And I say it literally. I do not know of a stupider people than the Jewish people. God gave us brains and we have blown it. And that Jews side with those who hate them. A Holocaust survivor, I forget, Hedy Kaplan, I think it was her name, went to Gaza to support them during one of the wars with Israel. What? Is this woman not sick? These people have announced they wish to annihilate Israel. They send up swastikas on the kites. There's swastikas on the kites because they say we want to eradicate Israel, and you have Jews supporting the Gazans. I debated at Oxford, the most prestigious forum of debate in the world, and two against two. One of the two that I debated against was an Israeli Jew, and the topic was, who is the greater threat to peace, Hamas or Israel? Here's an Israeli Jew, professor of international relations at Oxford, arguing that Israel is the greater obstacle to peace. No group produces such a high proportion of fools as the Jewish people.
And to your point about the irony, but not really an irony when you understand the history and the mass psychology of inviting people into your midst who state that they wish to kill you, and then arguing that is a moral, just, virtuous thing. Is that something in the Western psyche where we possess this perverse, self-righteously suicidal philosophy?
It seems to be. I don't know who else possesses this. It would seem to be that. That's right. We are so noble. It's ironic because it's a sort of imitatio Christ. It's, you know, let's be crucified for the sake of our beliefs. It really has an element of that in Western culture. It's like the hair shirt. There's something noble of suffering for your cause, it's noble to suffer for your cause if your cause is noble.
In a recent column, you wrote, somewhat tangentially related to what we were just discussing, about immigration in America, and you counter those who say that immigration restriction, or whatever you want to call it, being more discerning, having a rational immigration system, that those who support that view are cast as xenophobic. And you said, we're not xenophobic, we're value phobic. That is, our job is to bring in people who will add to the values and principles and subscribe to the values and principles that made this country what it is. I wonder if you'd elaborate on that argument a little bit.
I wish people, I write a column every week. I have for about 20 years. Obviously, every columnist wants to be read, but that's one column I do wish everybody read about the issue, why there is a problem at all with immigration and illegal immigration, and that it has nothing to do with xenophobia but values phobia. And I gave the example. You see, my theory, it's not even my theory. I mean, it's as obvious as the day is long. People who come into a culture can change the culture. Did Europeans change North American culture? Well, I suspect so. And by the way, there many on the left not only acknowledge that, they lament it. But they have to admit, let us say that the American Indian, the indigenous people as they're called, Native Americans, had the power to stop European immigration into North America and South America. Would the left call them xenophobic? It's an interesting question I'd like to pose to a leftist. If Indians said, no Europeans, you're going to change our culture, we don't want your culture, would they be called xenophobic? Of course not. It's a phony, like everything the left does. They use terms, and it's a fraud. It's a moral fraud. They don't mean it. They don't know it. They have no idea what they're talking about. I give a modern, internal, domestic American example. New Yorkers changed Florida's values. Florida was a rock-solid conservative state. Then Northeasterners, mostly New Yorkers, started moving in, and now South Florida is as left-wing as Berkeley or Santa Monica, and it's because New Yorkers moved in. People, so you don't need. Am I xenophobic because I don't want New Yorkers in Florida? No, I'm values phobic. I admit it. I fear values that I think are nihilistic. I think leftist values are nihilistic. I think that Muslim values, acknowledging that there are any number of wonderful individual Muslims, but those are not my values. That vis-a-vis women, vis-a-vis gays, vis-a-vis theocracy, they're not my values. So whereas people came in the past to become American and adopt our values, today the numbers do not necessitate that. The numbers allow you to bring Ecuador with you. That's different.
Next to the family, education is probably the seminal area that influences, obviously, what people believe, ultimately the culture, and by dint of changing the culture, the politics as well. You created PragerU, which is just a tremendous service to society, and it in part helps educate people and in some respects fixes the wrong ideas that they've been taught in their educational institutions and in pop culture. If you had an infinite budget, what would you do? What would be the single most important thing to do to change American culture?
If I then all I would do is market more. I have felt, and this will sound odd to many of your listeners, and I only say it because it's true, acknowledging that it will sound odd. I felt since I was really a kid that there was a solution. I knew of a solution to cancer, and the biggest problem was getting people to know it exists. I believe that the combination of Judeo-Christian, Torah, and American values is the greatest combination of values ever devised and is the solution to evil, which is the only thing that preoccupies me, evil. And therefore, we're publicizing that in PragerU in every dimension of life, economics, philosophy, religion, psychology. So with an unlimited budget, we would saturate the world with the videos. They would be in Chinese, they would be in Japanese, etc. And we would publicize them on every forum so that this year we'll have 1 billion views. But with an unlimited budget, I would want 5 billion, 20 billion views. That's our dream. I just spoke in Romania to 1,500 young people because of PragerU videos. And they're not in Romanian. I wish they were. But that's all that's necessary. The left-right battle is so easy to win if we can just expose people for 5 minutes at a time to the conservative ideas, as I just spoke of, Judeo-Christian and American values. Many people often say to me, you know, I listen to you on the radio and it just makes common sense. I said, yes, common sense is conservative. They're synonymous. Leftism is not common sense. What left-wing position is common sense? That's the amazing thing. They all feel good, but they're not the product of common sense. It's not common sense to raise the minimum wage and then have restaurants close or use robots. That's what's happening more and more. And so the poor guy who needs a beginning job at Burger King isn't going to be hired because he's been priced out of the market. And now people will order on an iPad, which is what's happening. But the left doesn't care because they love ideas, not people. I've known this my whole life, how much meanness is on the left. When I see the way they go into restaurants and scream epithets at Republicans who are having dinner, scream in front of where they live, no justice, no sleep. We don't do that. We just don't do that. We're nicer. Dave Rubin is a gay liberal Jew. And it was the revelation of his life that conservatives who didn't even agree with same-sex marriage, like me, are nicer human beings than his team. This was revelatory to him.
In order to compete, to educate, to advocate, and to debate in a marketplace of ideas, the first thing that you need is, of course, the First Amendment. The First Amendment finds itself besieged on all sides, and in particular, it starts at college campuses. You've toured around the country in connection with your movie that'll come out, No Safe Spaces, and you've seen these students and the odious kind of philosophies around free speech and open debate. How perilous is the First Amendment today? How perilous is its position?
Oh, very. According to Pew, I believe it was Pew, not Gallup, but it might have been Gallup, but I think it was Pew, almost 50% of American college students do not believe in free speech for hate speech, not understanding that that means they don't believe in free speech. I mean, it's so absurd. This is a perfect example. Oh, I believe it shows you the lack of intellectual rigor on the left is truly frightening. Oh, I believe in free speech, just not for hate speech. But then you don't believe in free speech. You're determining what you call hate speech. So it's at the end of the issue. By the way, the Wall Street Journal had a very important piece recently that the ACLU has now become a left-wing organization, is no longer preoccupied with free speech. When I was a kid, Nazis marched through Skokie, Illinois. They picked Skokie because there were a lot of Holocaust survivors there, so they're particularly despicable, the Nazis. And the ACLU was adamant that they be allowed to go on with their march, to march as Nazis in a Holocaust survivor's neighborhood. And they were right. In America, Nazis can march. That's the point of free speech. I don't think the ACLU today would, in fact, argue that. They have bought the left-wing position that hate speech is not protected speech. And by the way, that's obviously hate speech. The hate speech that the left talks about today is this broadcast. This broadcast would be deemed hate speech by the left.
Which is a good segue into the litigation between PragerU and social media companies, in particular YouTube/Google. And I've written pretty extensively, and everyone knows, they see it in the news frequently, of the wrong ideas, wrong think, hate speech, quote unquote, getting taken down, censored, discriminated against, people being deplatformed in the digital realm. As someone who defends free speech quite eloquently and quite robustly, how do you square the idea of potentially regulating in some form or fashion or litigating against these social media companies when, of course, their position will be, look, we're private companies and we have the right to determine what is disseminated and what is not disseminated on our platforms? So the idea
if they would say, then let's call for honesty. We are not a platform. We are not an open platform on the internet. That is, we said we were. We were fooling you. We're a left-wing organization, and we will determine what is allowed. Then I have no argument. But they want, even the judge that ruled in their favor said that this was, what is the term? When an advertiser exaggerates, there's a term. But anyway, she used the term. It was sort of like hyper. This is just hyper stuff. In other words, we know it's not true. It's like when a car dealer says, you know, this is the best car in the world. Nobody believes it. But so they don't mind it. That's what she said. This is what YouTube and Google do. They claim they're open, but that's just hyperventilating. In fact, it isn't the case. So they can't have it both ways. They can't lie to the world and get away with it. So either you are open to ideas you like, not open to all ideas, or you are open to all ideas. We're asking for a clarification. You can't be a national or an international conduit and be closed. You're not an international conduit then. So does the government have the right to say be open? That's an interesting question. But let's at least begin with honesty. You're not open. So the question is, can you be a utility that isn't open? If the water and power company said, we will charge conservatives more money for their water and power, can they do that? It's a private company, right? You're allowed to discriminate on the basis of ideas, not race. So can the water and power company say we charge more for conservatives?
One more substantive question and two very brief ones. Substantive question is, what do you view as the biggest threat to America and the West today?
Leftism. Left. It's not even, there are no other threats. But the irony is, when they're honest, they admit it. They can't stand Western civilization. The president said we have to protect Western civilization in a speech in Warsaw, and the New York Times and every other left-wing source editorialized that it was just a dog whistle for white supremacy. So for the left, the concept of Western civilization is really identical with white supremacy. So they take down Shakespeare's mural at the University of Pennsylvania English department because he's a white European male. But his picture was not up because he's a white European male. It was up because he's the finest playwright in human history. Japanese believe that. Chinese believe that. Hindus believe that. That's why the whole world reads Shakespeare. The whole world listens to Bach. The best Bach today comes out of Japan. They don't care if he's a white European male. They care that he's wrote the best music ever written.
They don't equate the Western canon and actually the values and principles that the West is based on with Western civilization. I found it ironic attacking the G7 or attacking NATO, and the press will say, how could you attack our Western allies? But they're Western allies in name only. The systems in these countries do not at all reflect anything that we talked about before: individualism, private property rights, rule of law, free speech, and the like. So it's the most disingenuous argument that could be made.
Under disingenuous, indeed, in an accurate dictionary, would be synonymous with left. Of course, they use whatever line works at the moment. All of a sudden, they're big protectors of the Western alliance. You know, but the left was opposed to Reagan calling the Soviet Union an evil empire, was opposed to Reagan bringing Pershing missiles into Western Europe. So it's a fraud. The whole thing's a fraud. But it's truly, we're blanketed by fraud. Because every network but Fox, every newspaper but the Wall Street Journal, it's astonishing, is blankets the country with these dishonest lines.
Who are the authors, or what are the publications that you read regularly?
I read everything. I mean, I don't mean literally everything. In other words, everything ideologically. In other words, I read the New York Times. I read the Wall Street Journal. I read the Washington Post. And of course, websites of right and left. I have to. Anyway, I want to know what they're saying. It's they don't know. They don't want to know what we're saying. That's. I never met a leftist who went to town hall, or Daily Caller, or Daily Wire, or Breitbart, or the Wall Street Journal, for that matter. They don't. I don't blame them. See, when I read the left, it reinforces my conservatism. But they have a deep suspicion that if they read us, it could shake them. That's why they don't want kids to even have 5 minutes of conservatism. Leftism is so thin intellectually that I think deep down, many of them understand how fragile their intellectual edifice is, and that just letting us in for 5 minutes, what's a PragerU video is 5 minutes, but it could shake their foundations.
Lastly, what are the books that had the greatest influence on your thinking in life?
Well, I have a list of them at the DennisPrager.com. And there was actually a list there. And I don't remember the whole list myself, but the first and foremost is the Torah. I mean, I have to admit, the older I get, the more I realize how it's influenced me. That's why I'm writing this huge commentary for non-Jews and Jews and atheists, called the Rational Bible, five volumes on the first five volumes of the Bible. It has so influenced my thinking. That's number one by far. But other things that I have listed, Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, had a very deep impact on me. The guy made me realize that we yearn for meaning as much as we yearn for food. In other words, right after food, before sex, we crave meaning. Sex is powerful, but there are people who have no sex who lead a happy life. There is nobody without meaning who leads a happy life. This is why he's so powerful, and he is one of the few that could be considered classic. The Man's Search for Meaning, he's died, Viktor Frankl, but that book is still a number one bestseller. And there are many other great aspects to the book. It's a very brief book. It was a Jewish psychoanalyst who was in a Nazi camp. George Gilder's books on men and sex were transformative to me.
Sexual Suicide.
That was its original title. That was the book, Sexual Suicide. Now, I don't know, there's another title for it. But Sexual Suicide, I read in college, and he was like 32 when he wrote it. The guy's a genius. Very deep man. That was very powerful. And that and Naked Nomads, there were two of them. So they really did. There's a I don't remember the names of the authors, but it's on my list. There's only one biography on the list, as far as I know, and that is of Mao. I think it's that important, that book. This is The Secret Life of Mao or something like that. It's 1,000 pages. I don't like reading 1,000-page books, but and it took me months, because I marked it up a lot, but that was transformative. So anyway, the list is on is at DennisPrager.com.
Dennis, thank you so much.
Ben, thank you.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please do help us out by subscribing to, rating, and reviewing Big Ideas with Ben Weingarten in the iTunes store or wherever else you're listening to us. I'm your host, Ben Weingarten. You can find out more about the podcast at benweingarten.com/bigideas or at BHWeingarten on Twitter. Thanks so much for listening, and we hope you'll join us next time.